You like elephants, Niall, don't you? In fact, you've come across many in your time.
I think everyone likes elephants, Derek. I saw them most recently in Sri Lanka when I was there last year, and the Asian elephants that are there, remarkable creatures. I've been blessed to see them in South Africa as well. I think you've probably seen them there yourself.
I did.
Amazing, aren't they?
How do you know the difference between an Asian and an African elephant?
Well, unless there's some sort of joke you're setting up there.
No.
Is that like a punchline to something? No, the fact is, well, the African elephants are a bit bigger and they have larger ears. That's one of the main things. Also, the head shape is different. Interestingly, actually, when I was in Sri Lanka, the elephants there, which are still massive animals, very few of the elephants in Sri Lanka have tusks. It's kind of a known feature of the elephants.
I used to be told the difference is in the ears, quite literally, that the African elephant's ears were the shape of Africa.
Yes, they are, yeah.
And the Asian elephant's ears are the shape of Asia. Is that true?
Well, the African ones, yeah. Well, if you look at a globe or look at a map of the world, yes, roughly the African elephant's ears are roughly the shape of Africa. I don't think the Asian ones, though, are the shape of Asia. Asia's
a
very strange
shape. Was I setting you up for a joke? No, but I did hear a ridiculous joke when I was on a tour in Manchester last week. Would you like to hear it, Niall?
Of course I
would. You've no choice. This moth goes into a doctor and says, "Doctor, doctor, I feel like a moth." And the doctor replies, "You'll need to see a psychiatrist." And he says, "I know, but your light was on."
Oh, God.
Anyway, back to elephants. A new study has revealed how the loss of experience to individual elephants stops the knowledge transfer between generations. Makes sense. This in turn puts elephant societies at risk. The research was led by Dr. Lucy Bates from the University of Portsmouth's Centre for Comparative and Evolutionary Psychology. We spoke with her earlier.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be part of the programme. So with my research, we were looking at the effects of disrupting elephant societies. So when, particularly through human disturbance, individuals are removed from the social groups, and then trying to see if that had any particular effects on the elephants that remain. Because elephants live in very close-knit societies, very structured social groups. So we were just wondering what happens when individuals are removed, perhaps through things like poaching or culling exercises, what kind of implications that has for the elephants that remain.
Now, was your research carried out on captive elephants or elephants in the wild?
All the research that we studied was carried out with wild elephants. Unfortunately, for this piece of research, I didn't actually get to spend any time with elephants. It was very much a desk-based study looking at the effects that other people have noticed in the past from when they've been observing elephants.
So how did you go about the study then?
So we drew together all the research that's been published on wild elephants across Africa and Asia, and then using set search terms, narrowed that list of initially about 4,000 research papers down to a final group of about 95 research papers that detailed some kind of disruption to the social group. So whether that was one elephant being killed or whether that was a really high proportion of the population being killed through something like poaching. And then we looked at any implications of that, any effects or responses that were reported in other people's research, and then pulled all that together to try and understand general patterns about how elephants respond to any kind of disruption in their social group.
And you found patterns, presumably?
Yes, yeah. Some quite clear patterns emerged from all of that. The most important one, I think, is that when it's elders that are removed, so when the elder individuals of elephant society are removed or killed or taken away from the society, the remaining population shows really quite profound changes. So the social groupings that remain are much looser, much less cohesive. The calves that are born are much less likely to survive. And the individuals that are left in the population might show very inappropriate responses to threats and predators around them, for example.
Now, when you say inappropriate responses, what do you mean exactly?
So they might, for example, they can waste their energy on overreacting to less dangerous threats. And when they're faced with a real threat, something that's genuinely dangerous, they might not do enough to protect themselves and their calves, for example. So they essentially just do the wrong thing at the wrong time when they haven't got that guidance from a knowledgeable elder present in their social group.
So they need a mother or father figure.
Yeah, very much a mother figure. So we were looking at family groups, and the adult males don't tend to hang around with the mother, with the family groups. So it's very much being led by a matriarch, the mother, who can be the mother, grandmother, aunt of all the other individuals in the family.
Richard.
Lucy, you give the impression that they have nervous breakdowns almost in the face of trauma. Now, there could be two elements there. That could be the need to change their behaviour in the face of dangers, or it could be that memory is lost with the old person, the old individuals. The old individuals are receptacles of memory and experience. And if they're taken out, suddenly the whole community is vulnerable, is it not? What is the dominant thing, the loss of memory or the emotional trauma?
I think that's the million-dollar question, and at the moment I'm not sure we really know the answer to that. I suspect that both can be very important, perhaps in slightly different circumstances. If it's just the loss of an elder and the rest of the family stays relatively intact, we will see effects, we will see problems, such as these inappropriate responses to the sort of, it's the very nuanced decisions that can go a bit awry, I think, without the sort of leading light of the matriarch, the knowledgeable elder. But I think in other situations where a number of individuals are removed or killed, or, for example, youngsters are raised without any adults, then I think in those situations the trauma can be really important as well. But we haven't yet got the ability to differentiate between those two, I think, at the moment. So we're trying to work out what the difference is, what the causes might be.
Now, elephants live in two communities, really. The females and the calves all live together in an integrated herd. I suppose up to 8 years on, the males are removed, driven out of that society, and they live independent lives, either in little groups of bachelor males or on their own. Now, in other words, the female, the matriarch, the old lady, she is the one that has all the knowledge. She knows where the water may be available in times of drought. She knows the caves into which elephants can go to get salt, and so on and so forth. So she's the one that calls the shots. She's the managing director of the whole operation. The male is sort of ancillary. He's only there to fertilize the odd female on visits, one-night stands. But therefore, the loss of females is much more significant, perhaps, is it, than the loss of males?
I think what you're saying about the loss of females in the families is absolutely correct. That the loss of those females is a real problem for the family groups. But I think a lot of newer research now is beginning to suggest that the loss of males is important too for the younger males. So as you say, males start to leave their family and become independent from around the age of 8 to 10 onwards, perhaps reaching full independence by sort of 15, 16 years old. But even at that age, even when they become fully independent from their family, they do try very often to group with other males, and those younger males prefer the company of older males. So they're sort of seeking out an older individual themselves that they can learn from and follow, we think. So the loss of older males can still be very damaging to those younger individuals. And I think particularly in some cases where there's a lot of conflict or problems perhaps with people living alongside elephants, it's quite often the males that perpetrate that those problems, those conflict situations. So by removing the older males who might behave better, we could be creating more problems for people living alongside elephants as well.
I remember a warden telling me in Umfolozi when I visited many years ago that there were no old males in the population, and the young bucks coming up were difficult. They were boisterous and causing trouble. And the management of the park moved big males in to put manners on these junior males. Does that ring true to you?
Yes, that certainly does ring true. There have been a couple of situations, particularly in national parks in South Africa, as you say, where that situation has arisen, where there have only been younger bulls and they have behaved essentially very badly, sometimes extremely badly and aggressively, even killing other rhinos, for example, because these younger bulls start to get a surge of testosterone younger than they would ordinarily, because there are no older bulls to suppress it. And they almost don't know what to do with it, I think. They're sort of so overwhelmed by the hormones and they start to behave incredibly badly and inappropriately. And in all situations where that has arisen, bringing in an older bull who does know how to behave and does know how to handle his hormonal changes, it immediately suppresses that bad behaviour in the youngsters. So I think there's definitely a role for the older male elephants.
Even though he's not in the herd except very occasionally. However, is this true also of the Asian elephant? The African elephant is the big troublemaker, I suppose. The Asian has a long association with us, and there's a huge population of domesticated elephants there. Do these rules, this sort of pattern, apply to domestic ones as well?
It's much harder to know for sure with the Asian elephants. There's been much less of this kind of research conducted. And also in wild Asian elephant populations, there seems to be the social grouping is a bit different and it's much less matriarch-driven in families, for example. But having said that, social groups are still very important. So although it works slightly differently, there is still a really important role for social groups and with the males as well, in that slightly looser way that we see with African elephants as well. So I think at the moment, the short answer is we don't know for sure, but I suspect that these patterns we see will replicate to some extent with Asian elephants. Quite how that works with captive Asian elephants and all the elephants that are used across Asia in various captive settings, it's a bit harder to say because they're managed and looked after by people, and their social interactions are a bit more limited because there are fewer of them. So how it plays out with those individuals, I don't know.
Is it possible, therefore, to train elephants? These are highly intelligent, adaptable creatures. Can they be trained to live in relative harmony with us and not intrude too much? I'm thinking, of course, of George Orwell's famous Shooting the Elephant story. He was a police officer in Burma, I think it was, when an elephant who had for years been docile suddenly went berserk and killed someone. And poor Orwell was forced to shoot it, a thing he didn't want to do. But is it possible that some sort of détente can be developed between ourselves and elephants, because they're doing a lot of damage in Africa particularly, and in Asia, damaging crops and getting into rows with farmers and so on and so forth? We know, for instance, that you can control them with beehives and imitation beehives. Is it possible that some sort of equilibrium can be established, a protocol by which they can live side by side with us and without too much conflict?
I hope so. But I'm not sure so much that they can be trained in the sense of, for example, being taught to not eat certain things. A lot of the conflict arises over elephants eating crops, for example. And I think it would be extremely difficult to persuade a wild elephant that it can and can't eat accessible crops. But I think one thing that can very much be done is using strategies to, for example, allow elephants to move to the areas they want to move and pass by crops by planting other things that they don't want to eat, or other deterrents like the beehive fences, as you mentioned. I think a reasonable amount of research has shown that ultimately, given the option, elephants would rather not interact with people, especially in these threatening situations. So I think one important thing is allowing elephants an escape route so that they don't encounter people in these threatening situations. And that would be safer for the people and safer for the elephants. So I think a lot of it is about how we plan and use the land that, elephants and people are sharing.
You mention a route there. Elephants roam vast distances in search of food, in search of water and so forth. Are the passages, the traditional passages that existed long ago and existed until recently indeed, are these now being blocked? And should we maintain and keep them open in the interests of harmony with elephants?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of these passages and historic migration routes are gradually or quite rapidly in some cases becoming blocked by infrastructure or people moving into the area and setting up homes in areas. One, that there is a big push now to try and encourage corridors, so linking areas of sort of habitual elephant use and encouraging the people that live alongside those corridors to undertake certain mitigation methods to avoid conflict with the elephants. So I think that is something that's happening gradually now, and there's a real awareness that it needs to happen, but it's obviously quite difficult, you know, that there's a whole lot of processes that need to happen, from liaising with people and local governments and national governments, to make that kind of process really work. But I think it will become increasingly important, especially as the elephants' habitats are changing with respect to water availability and things. So knowledge and of access to these historic sites that might have permanent water or alternative feeding grounds will become increasingly important for the elephants that are remaining.
Can I ask you about some of the peculiar things that elephants are accredited with? For instance, they are said to paint pictures if you give them a brush and a canvas or a sheet of paper, and that they come back, and when they come back, they can recognize their own picture, not mistake it for someone else. Is this actually true?
I'm certainly aware of elephants painting pictures in certain captive facilities. I haven't actually heard that they can then recognise their own picture, but I wouldn't be surprised that they could do it. It could be based on a number of different things. It could be about the smell. They could recognise their own smell on the picture, for example, or they might recognise the visual pattern that they have created. I don't think that would be beyond them, but it's not something I'm aware has ever been tested rigorously.
Yes, you could take the picture it painted and develop a facsimile of it and put it in. There would be no smell then. And you would be able to test whether or not it was the image the elephant created that is remembered. It would be a very interesting thing to do that. Another curious thing is the myth. Is it a myth that elephants have graveyards? Is there any basis for that?
I don't believe elephants have graveyards as such. I think there have historically been collections of bones that have gathered in an area that could look like a graveyard, for example. But I think the theory there is that actually, for example, when elephants get older and their teeth are wearing out, they might gather in areas with with a lot of accessible water and softer vegetation. And that's the area where these older elephants then die. And if several elephants over many generations are doing that, then you could sort of, a lot of elephant carcasses might build up over years that could start to look like an elephant graveyard, for example. There was a very intriguing case reported last year from a tea plantation in India. There were a number of calves that looked like they had been buried. But I think it's not entirely verified that is the case yet. It could be possible that actually these calves were either drowned or stuck in mud, because all of them occurred during periods of very heavy monsoon rainfall. And it's possible that the calves were then sort of washed down and trapped in these flows of mud. So they hadn't been intentionally buried by the elephants, but had just accidentally died there. But when then discovered by people subsequently, it looked like they had been buried in the mud.
It's very hard not to be anthropomorphic when it comes to elephants. We're inclined to project they're so like us in so many ways, it would seem. When we see them, as we do apparently, investigating at the carcass of an elephant they come upon and lifting the bones up and inspecting them, we are inclined to say, oh, it's grieving, it's got an attachment, it's sad because it's found a member of its species and so on and so forth. Do you accept that kind of view or do you reject that as fancy?
I try very hard to be a dispassionate scientist, but as you say, it is extremely difficult with a species like elephants to not anthropomorphize, especially when you're spending a lot of time watching them. You know the individuals that you're looking at and their lives sort of play out as a soap opera in front of your eyes. It can be extremely difficult from first-hand experience to not anthropomorphize in general, but particularly, as you say, when they encounter bones or a carcass. But actually, I find that extremely powerful when they do encounter a carcass. It's difficult to really explain, but their whole demeanor, their whole countenance changes, and they can go from being sort of loud and boisterous and generally sort of messing around and making a lot of noise, and as they approach a carcass or even bones that are decomposing, they become very still and quiet, and they vocalize much less. The calves sort of stop playing around, and it certainly gives the impression that they are acting in a more respectful way. What that feels like to them, whether that is a feeling of grief and sadness, I wouldn't like to say, but they certainly do change their behaviour.
Dr. Lucy Bates. More details, as always, on the website rte.ie/Mooney.